Tonight our lesson is taken from a word that is used in the King James Version. When I first became a Christian, I had a copy of the King James Version, and I learned in Bible classes much of the language contained in the King James Version. And one of the words that's unique to the King James Version is used, and I've decided to entitle our lesson around that word tonight. There are two passages. Titus 2 and verse 14 in the King James Version said, "Who gave himself for us, that he might redeem us from all iniquity, and purify unto himself a peculiar people, zealous of good works." And then in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9, "But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." Many of the newer translations that are used today say something different. But in times past, and maybe during the present time, while many people still use the cherished King James Version, some people have taken the word peculiar to mean cranky or eccentric. Some have even adopted odd ways of doing things and then commented, "Well, you know, the Bible says that we're peculiar people." And I don't really think that that's the sense of the passage. In Vine's Dictionary of New Testament Words, he doesn't define peculiar as eccentric or cranky. He says that the word means an obtaining, an acquisition, as in a purchased possession. This is further supported by other lexicons of the New Testament and reflected in translations like the New American Standard Bible, which I used to preach from, in Titus 2 and verse 14, where it does not use the phrase "a peculiar people," but it says "a people for his own possession," reflecting the true meaning of the original words. 1 Peter 2 and verse 9, "a people for God's own possession." Now, it is true, however, that the people that God has obtained, acquired, purchased for his own possession are different people. They are much different from the people of the world, or should be. Romans 12 and verse 2, "And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is perfect, that which is good and acceptable and perfect." So in contrast, so long as one has the mind of the flesh, you know, he will not please God in this manner. He will follow after the things of the flesh. So long as he thinks the thoughts of the people of the world, he will follow the activities of the world. And he'll continue to be fashioned according to the world. The wise man has expressed the principle this way in Proverbs 23 and verse 7, "For as he thinks within himself, so is he. Or as a man is in his heart, that's the way his life will be." Not that thinking himself to be good will make him good, or thinking himself to be evil will make him evil, but the man whose thoughts are filled with good thoughts will have a life that's filled with good actions, and he will be a good man. That's Proverbs 23 and verse 7. Then Peter wrote in 1 Peter 4, verses 1 and 2, "Therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with this same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God." That certainly draws the contrast between what a peculiar person is, or a person purchased of God, as as opposed to the people in the world, doesn't it? Why are God's people different? In the first place, I want to suggest to you, out of these two basic reasons that I've thought about, they have a God that is different from the gods of human origin. They have a God that is not made up from the imagination of the minds of men. The people of the true and living God worship and serve the true and living God that didn't originate in the imagination of man, but is reality. Their God is not the work of man's hands. It's not the product of man's imagination. Here is an excerpt from the sermon of Paul on Mars Hill in Athens in Acts chapter 17, beginning in verse 24. And here's what he says. The God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he served by humans' hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and exist, even as some of your own poets have said, for we are also his children. Being then the children of God, we ought not to think that divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. Paul perfectly contrasts there the true and living God with the gods of human imagination. God made man, but man made all the other gods. Since nothing is ever greater than its maker, man's gods, other than Jehovah, of course, are never greater than man. Why are God's people different? In the first place, they have a God that is different from the imagination of men. And secondly, they follow a different teaching. Notice what is said of Jesus' teaching. When Jesus had finished these words, the crowds were amazed at his teaching. Why so? Verse 29 of Matthew 7 tells us, "For he was teaching them as one having authority and not as their scribes." Jesus taught something that to the current status quo of religious-minded people who did worship and serve Jehovah God, it was amazing to them. And that should make us sit up and take note, I think. During the feast, the chief priests and the Pharisees sent officers to take Jesus, but they came back without doing so. When they were asked why they did not bring him, John's Gospel records their answer in John 7 and verse 46. The officers answered, "Never has a man spoken the way this man speaks." That should cause us to sit up and take note, don't you think? To note that one huge difference in God's people and the rest of the world is that they follow a teaching that is quite unique and originated in the mind of God. Why are God's people different? They have a God that is different from the gods of human origin, and they follow a different teaching. That we might be impressed with the different nature of God's people, let us review some of the basic ideas of human society with their accompanying practices in comparison with the teachings of Christ that Jesus Christ spoke or had his apostles teach in his name. And I think we will see a vast difference. One of the ideas that has always dominated the world is the idea of getting, of obtaining, of acquiring wealth, massing wealth for oneself. Money or wealth is a great source of worldly pride and pleasure, among men. That concept is no strange concept to us. It will provide more worldly honor and more fleshly satisfaction than anything else known to man in the present world. It is little wonder that men generally have made a mass rush to accumulate as much as they possibly can. Far too many are guilty of covetousness. Some are also so obsessed with the idea of obtaining and getting and pursuing that many times they throw their honesty in the trash can. Their fairness and their righteous dealings with people, they throw in the dumpster. They rid themselves of high moral principles in order to selfishly possess whatever they can possibly possess for themselves. It is greedily wanting something in ways that contradict righteousness and forget other principles of good judgment before God. That's what covetousness is. There are things in this life that we have no right to possess. There are things in this life that we should not possess because they are spiritually detrimental to us. They're not spiritually beneficial for us to obtain. It's interesting that Paul identifies covetousness with idolatry in Ephesians 5 and verse 5. This is what he said, "For this you know with certainty, that no immoral or impure person or covetous man who is an idolater has an inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God." The material things that we love are oftentimes worshipped in place of the position that God should normally occupy in our lives. Things become too important to us, and we kick God out of His rightful place as number one priority in our lives, and forget God, and forget His Word, and pursue things that would only end up harming us in the long run. Spiritual life isn't dependent upon the amount or the kind of one's possessions. The soul is eternal. Material things perish. If life is things to us, then we really have no substance to our inner being, do we? If all of our life is wrapped up in temporal, material things that will perish, what is that to say for our souls and the content of our hearts? If the direction of life is gaining things, we will be sorely disappointed. This getting has probably been the most common cause for stealing, lying, crimes committed in our society, like murder and other crimes. Many of the crimes on the books have to do with this pursuit of material things, don't you think? Lack of contentment, the love of money, the desire to be rich, all of these things are described in the pages of our Bibles as roots. Roots of all sorts of evil in 1 Timothy 6, verses 1 through 10. And certainly there are a host of temptations that are also associated with the gaining of material wealth that are exceedingly dangerous to our souls. If we're to see the real picture in contrast between God's people and the people of the world, we must not only consider the fact that God's people do not live to get, but they live to give. Paul in Ephesians 4 and verse 28, "He who steals must steal no longer, but rather he must labor, performing with his own hands what is good, so that he will have something to share with one who has need." That draws a clear picture of the contrast between God's purchased or peculiar people and the people of the world, doesn't it? The motive for working must go beyond our own supply. The Christian's interest lies in providing, giving, generosity toward others rather than getting rich. Another idea that has always dominated the world is that people have sought to be served in this life. People of the world have measured greatness by the number of people who serve them, who do their bidding, who follow their instructions to the letter. Jesus spoke about this in Matthew 20, beginning in verse 20, and here's what he said. When the mother of the sons of Zebedee came to Jesus with her sons, bowing down and making a request of him, and of course he asked her, What do you wish? She said to him, command that you're in your kingdom. These two sons of mine may sit on your right hand, one on your right hand and one on your left. But Jesus answered, you do not know what you are asking. Her concept of sitting on his right hand and his left hand needed some improvement, didn't it? You do not know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink? To her two sons. And you know what their answer was, don't you? Oh yes, we are able. Oh yes, we are able. He said to them, my cup you shall drink. Even though they didn't really fully understand what was in that cup, did they? Of what it consisted. Oh, my cup you shall drink. But to sit on my right hand and my left is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared of my Father. And hearing this, the ten became indignant with the two brothers. But Jesus called them to himself and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. It is not this way among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. And whoever wishes to be first among you shall be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. What a great lesson that is about the way we should be in this life when it comes to, do we want people serving us or do we want to serve other people? That's a choice that we have to make, isn't it? To sit at the right and the left would not only be a position of honor for these two brothers. It would also be a position of great authority. Nothing moves the indignation of men more than to know that one in a company of equals is plotting to get an undue advantage over the others. Have you seen this happen in the workplace? Have you seen it happen in a group of people with which you've been associated in the past? A group of equals, and you find out that someone is plotting for an undue advantage over everyone else, and you know the unpleasant way that that makes you feel. Honor in the Lord's kingdom comes through servitude. Jesus taught us that. The Lord enforces the lesson by his own example. Follow my example. What a great lesson that is. People in this life have sought to be served. If we're to be different, if we're to be God's purchased people, if we're to be peculiar, we will be people who seek to serve other people rather than be served. And then, thirdly, according to the ideas which have always dominated society, when one was wronged by his fellow man, he was really expected to avenge that wrong. But Jesus didn't teach that. Jesus didn't teach us to take vengeance on other people. As a matter of fact, Jesus taught in Matthew 5, beginning in verse 38, in the Sermon on the Mount, You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other also to him. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile with him, go two. Show yourself to be a different person. Show yourself to have something different about you. Different than what everyone else has, which is vengeance for every wrong and every evil that someone else does to us. It was never the law of God to proceed individually and personally against someone who did evil to you, even under the expression, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. One was to do that with judge and jury, not without. With the approval of the courts, not without. With the penalty inflicted by the officers of the law, not without. What is not to be resisted here is evil treatment at the hand of a neighbor. Even the most unjust and extreme extractions of the law, even those are not to be resisted by the Christian. They are to be endured without seeking revenge. How does a Christian respond to the demands of a government filled with tyranny? This is a passage that shows us how. With cheerful compliance. That's the way our Lord responded, wasn't it? With cheerful compliance. What a great and powerful example He is for us. And how much different that behavior is than the behavior we learn out here in the world. Paul, in the matter of brother going to law against brother, raised the question in 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 7, why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be defrauded? Whenever I read that passage, you know what immediately pops in my mind? This is a forgotten principle. We don't want to be wronged. We don't want to be defrauded. We live in a country where it seems that everyone around us, even from third grade age, is demanding my rights. Why? We are unwilling to suffer for, it seems, any reason whatsoever. This is a forgotten principle. Far too many refuse to suffer unjustly for any good reason. The laws of our land tell us, you have your rights. And the law of Christ says, do not defraud your neighbor of his rights. The law of our land says, you must not be wronged. But Christ says, it's better to suffer wrong than do wrong. There is a different way for the purchased people of God to live than the way the world lives, isn't there? And then finally, another attitude that seems to have always dominated the world's thinking has to do with a man's attitudes and dealings with his enemy. The world has expected man to love his friend and to do him good, but to hate his enemy and do him evil. Isn't that the way the world thinks? Jesus gave us a higher way to live. Also, in Matthew 5, beginning in verse 43, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. That's a comfortable way to live with us, isn't it? Jesus said, you've always heard this. You've lived like this. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Why? So that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. So that you may be the purchased people of God. So that you may be a peculiar people. For he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? If you just do the normal thing that everybody is doing and everybody is comfortable with doing, it really takes no effort. What reward is there in that? Do not even tax collectors do the same? This is the way people live who do not have any moral standards to live by. What good is there to live this way? If you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles the same? It might be impossible to have warm feelings toward someone who's doing evil to you or mistreated you in some way or another. And that's not what the passage is saying, have warm feelings for them. But it's not beyond our reach to treat them with kindness, to treat them with an undefeatable goodwill. The same type of goodwill that's undefeatable that God possesses by sending the rain on the just and the unjust. To love someone is to seek his best interest. And when we do this, we imitate God, don't we? These are four areas that I think we can see pretty clearly that there is a vast difference between the way the people of the world live and the way the Christian lives. And I think they illustrate the point rather well, don't you? There are many other points in Jesus' teaching which contrasts the general teaching and practices that man has held and does hold. But these four will really suffice to illustrate our point about God's people that are possessed by Him. It is not necessary for God's people to adopt odd, strange, unusual, or eccentric practices just to be different. All we need to do to be different is to follow God's teaching. All we need to do is strive to behave as Jesus behaved. That'll cause enough attention, won't it? People will see a light in us. People will see that we are truly the salt of the earth. God's people have different purposes, different ideas, different sense of values. We have different attitudes than the world has. We have different interests. We have different habits. Why? Because we have forsaken man's ways, and we are following the true and living God. God's thoughts are now our thoughts. We've been transformed by the renewing of our mind, to use an expression that Paul used to the Romans. And then, and only then, can the statement made by Paul be fully realized. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 17, therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creature. The old things passed away. Behold, new things have come. Let us think about those new things as Christians and how they differentiate us from the people of the world. And let's make that valley of separation deeper and wider, so that other people will see Christ living in us and they will want to obey the gospel and have the hope of heaven also. If you're in our assembly tonight and we can help you become a Christian, we'd be delighted to do that. If we can help you in any spiritual way to walk closer to God when you leave this building than when you first came in, we would be delighted to do that. Pray with you and pray for you in whatever your spiritual need is. That's our purpose here at the Old Hickory Church, to walk closer to God every day and to encourage everyone that we can to do the same. We want to go to heaven, and we want to take as many people with us as we possibly can. So if you're in our assembly and we can help you, please come to the front and let me know while we stand together and encourage you by singing number 321. May God bless you.